street epistemology is a wonderful approach that anyone can learn. You can learn more about street epistemology at streetepistemology.com.
I am so happy to be joined by Anthony Magnabosco, the legendary Anthony Magnabosco. He's one of the founders of Street Epistemology International, and he's the executive director today. I was influenced by Anthony's work in my process of learning how to teach critical thinking better in my class. And I found his channel, YouTube channel, and I ate it up, and oh my goodness, it is such an honor to be having a conversation right now with Anthony. So thank you, Anthony.
Hey, thank you very much. Nice to be here with you. Yeah, that was a great introduction too. I appreciate talking with you, and it's wild to think that just putting those videos out there, me using street epistemology with folks about the claims that they're making, is reaching folks who are also interested in this stuff, especially critical thinking. And I guess I never really quite thought about how when you're doing SE, it is sort of a critical thinking exercise, but it is. You're really exploring how your conversation partner is critically thinking, and you're looking for deficiencies in that. And there's that overlap there. So yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm fascinated with your approach, because I teach students how to think critically. And that approach is very much a one way, and part of it is because I teach online, for example, at this point, and it kind of has to be, but it's this like, well, this is how to think critically. And what you do is you teach them how to think critically through conversations. And to me, that would be leveling up. Like, you have to learn how to think critically first before you start to engage with somebody else. But actually, you're doing sort of the reverse of just teaching them how to think critically through the conversation. And it's a fascinating process.
It's a good way of framing it. Yeah. And again, like, I never considered that when I'm asking somebody about how they're reasoning to their conclusions, that in a way we are teaching critical thinking. But it was never my goal. And it's almost like it's an offshoot of the conversation. It's not the primary goal, I think. But when you're exploring people's beliefs and you start hearing the reasons that they're giving, and then more importantly, how they're confirming that those are good reasons, you start noticing deficiencies in the reasoning. And that's where a good solid understanding of critical thinking as the questioner is really key. Like, that helps. If you understand critical thinking and you can identify logical fallacies, that's quite useful. And your conversation partner may not necessarily be noticing those things until you start asking questions about their reasoning. And when you start exploring that with questions, they themselves begin to notice that there's some discrepancy. They may not be able to put their finger on it and say, oh, that's an argument from popularity, or that's an argument from ignorance, or something along those lines. But they notice that something's off, and it's that self-discovery. It's not me telling them, that's the argument ad populum that you've just done there. Like, it's nice to know it. But when you just profess it to somebody and they're in the process of defending or explaining their beliefs, it can cause defensiveness. So asking questions to help the person come to realize themselves that there might be an issue seems to be the magic of street epistemology. That's where the person is objectively thinking and critically reflecting about their reasoning that causes them to reassess their confidence in their conclusions. And that's a powerful mix. So the critical thinking aspect that comes with street epistemology is paramount.
I feel like we should probably get some definitions out of the way. So
yeah,
when I say critical thinking, because I've noticed that if you ask 10 educators that all teach critical thinking what that means to them, they're going to give you different definitions. To me, at its basis, it is being able to draw reasonable conclusions from the available evidence. So I guess I would like to hear your definition then of street epistemology.
Well, the definition I'm going to give you is the one that we've developed over the last 10 years, and it's kind of crystallized and codified over the last 2 years in coordination with Street Epistemology International and experts who are involved with street epistemology and the broader community. So we tested this, by the way. This isn't something that just a few people in a dark room put together. We've spent hours, literally thousands of hours of thousands of people hours putting this together. And the definition that we've come up with now is that street epistemology is a way of helping people critically reflect on the quality of their reasoning through civil conversation. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. We're aiming for that kind of critical reflection where somebody's seriously and honestly contemplating a discrepancy in their reasoning. And they're pondering about that and wondering, like, I thought this, but now I've got this competing idea here. What am I going to do with that? That's kind of what we're aiming for in street epistemology. And
That sounds
we generally get there by asking questions.
That sounds very similar then to critical thinking. It's just more of a guided process.
Maybe, maybe. Yeah. Like my definition of critical thinking, I would say, would be something like the ability to set aside all your biases and desires to objectively consider the structure of your reasoning, something along those lines, which is very similar maybe to street epistemology. Yeah.
I'm so glad you said that, actually, because what I've learned, I came at this from, I was teaching intro bio for non-majors for like 10 years, and I was trying really hard to, it's a gen ed science class. And the reason we teach gen ed science as an undergrad is to undergrads is so that we have well-rounded people who theoretically understand science. But I realized I was just asking my students to memorize a bunch of stuff, and I wasn't teaching them how the process of science actually worked. And the process of science has a lot of overlap with critical thinking. So the assumption, of course, is if you're teaching a science class, is that you're teaching critical thinking. And when I asked myself, I honestly, it was just pure frustration. And when I asked myself if I had a single semester to teach the average person what they needed to know about how science worked, what would that look like? And I threw the whole thing out and started over again. I looked around to see who was doing what. I learned. This is when I discovered your stuff, ate it up, right? There were so many people that influenced me. And what I learned was there was a lot I didn't know. And it was important stuff. You said understanding your biases and how they can impact your reasoning. What I learned, for example, is that in most science classes, we come in and we say, okay, here's the scientific method. And then here's everything we know from the process of science. And the problem with that is that that's not usually how science works. But more importantly, why do we need science to begin with? And we need science because our reasoning is flawed. Our perceptions are flawed. Our thinking is flawed. And if I don't start with that, with here's how your perceptions can mislead you, then a student says, well, I tried homeopathy and it worked, so therefore it worked. Well, how good is that evidence? Right? How might we use science to actually determine if homeopathy is effective? And so now when I teach science classes that do the traditional method of like starting with scientific method and then here's all this stuff, I feel like we're missing a major step. The logic of the process of science falls in place when you understand why we need it to begin with.
Yeah, I think that that's great that you sort of started off from scratch and said, how can we best teach these concepts to students? It's funny also that we sort of noticed along the way, I think there's an overlap of the scientific method with regards to critical thinking and of course, but also street epistemology. And it didn't really dawn on me until we started sketching out the high level steps of what do you do when you're doing a street epistemology conversation. And then we've noticed that there's overlap with the scientific method. It was a discovery of our own. Like, holy crap. When we're engaging with somebody about how they've reasoned to their conclusion, we're essentially walking through the scientific method. So there's the establishment of a claim or a hypothesis. We try to assess the person's feeling of confidence that the claim is true. We'll identify reasons that support the claim. That's evidence. We'll evaluate the epistemology or how did this individual assess their reasons or their evidence or their justifications? How did they do that? What was the process that they used to validate the quality of that reason? That's testing. And then there's other things that happen after the fact. You've got peer review and so forth, where other people are maybe weighing in. That was kind of a neat discovery that we're essentially walking people through a scientific rubric of their reasoning when we're doing street epistemology, essentially, because we want to drive down to the testing process that people are using to derive a confidence in the quality of their reasons that bring them to their comp to, that bring them to their conclusions, and then they act out on it. Like, we're acting out on our beliefs all the time, and it's so important to take a look at how we've reasoned to that. And yeah, the scientific method is a reflection of that, or SE is a reflection of the scientific method. I'm not sure how you want to look at it. I just lost your audio.
Is this better?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, it's almost like it's a process that we've learned that works over time because humans have been using the method and refining it over time. Actually, I would add one more
Yeah.
thing that I focus on with my students that overlaps with the scientific method, and that is the idea of being able to prove yourself wrong. So scientists don't set out to prove their claim right. They set out to disprove it. And there are claims that can't be disproven. In which case they're not science. So, step one, is this a falsifiable claim? If it is, let's try to falsify it. And that's a way to beat confirmation bias. Like, if I want to support one of my beliefs, I'm going to be able to find evidence to do it. The question is, if I was wrong, how would I know?
Yeah. So you're talking about disconfirmation here, and this is something that comes up a lot in a street epistemology type of conversation. We'll hear a claim, we'll hear a justification, and then we'll ask them, how can we test this collaboratively? How can we collaboratively test this reason to see if the confidence that you're deriving from it is justified? And that's usually what people will tend to start giving all sorts of confirmations that their test is true. But they don't very often, and just humans in general, including myself until maybe recently, most people don't consider, what would I need to see that would show me that this was not that this reason was not correct? What would a failed test look like? People are always geared towards confirming their beliefs, but they don't often consider what would disconfirm it. And it's ex the exploration of disconfirming reasons that tends to help people reflect on the quality of their reasoning. And there's an important mistake that a lot of here, this is a common mistake that a lot of people make, and it's important to bring it up. When you are talking with somebody, it's important that they come up with the disconfirmation criteria for their own reasoning, as opposed to you offering it. This is what we found, is that when you offer it, it's very easy to find reasons to shoot that down. But if your conversation partner is bringing up reasons that they would accept to lower their confidence, then these are legitimate reasons that they would entertain. Now, sometimes you get people who will say, but it's true. I can't show that it's false because it's real. You sometimes get that type of argumentation. But yeah, disconfirmation, defeasibility, these are all really important concepts to be able to have confidence in the test results. Because if we construct a test that only shows fail passes but never fails, how could you be so confident in the reliability of that test? You really can't. And that's an important concept. Words like disconfirmation or defeasibility go over people's heads, but if you talk about pass-fail testing, that seems to be more digestible.
Interesting. Pass fail testing. So, you said that SE has a lot of overlap with the scientific method. What does it have in common with the Socratic method?
That's another good question. Well, Socratic method and SE share some commonalities. I would say that we ask a lot of questions in street epistemology, and you'll notice a lot of questions in Socratic method. And it seems to me that in the Socratic method, there's more focus on what words mean. There's a lot of focus on the what, the actual claim. What do you mean by this word? What if somebody else thinks that it's this word? And there's this discussion about the what. Whereas we're more interested in justifications or the reasons, and we're really interested in epistemology, which is the how. How did you confirm that that's a good reason for thinking that your claim up here is true? And I've participated in a couple of experiments with the Socratic method. Donald Robertson, as you, I think I've introduced you to him, and I'm hoping that he reaches out to you to bring you on his podcast. He is very into the Socratic method, and he has a Facebook group, and he invited me to do some Socratic dialogue with people. And at the end of it, I was so frustrated because it was this discussion about the what and what these words meant, and there was very little about the applied outcomes from such thinking. And that's what I love about street epistemology is we're interested in the reasoning that drives people's behaviors to act out in the world. Whereas I felt like when I was doing the Socratic method discussion, it was all about what these words meant with very little real world impact. So I personally think SE is better than the Socratic method because we drive deeper. And now it's important to understand what words mean. However, when we're doing an SE type of conversation, generally, most people who practice it will roll with whatever words and definitions that our conversation partner has, because we want to work within their belief structure, within their model. And if we're working with different terms, it's not going to go anywhere. So we'll go with it. And if they want to revise a term because we've gotten a little bit deeper and they realize there's a deficiency and they want to make a correction, cool. But that's in a nutshell, that's primarily the difference as I see it. The other thing too is that with the Socratic method, I think a lot of people think you can use the Socratic method to teach people things. I'm going to use the Socratic method as a vehicle to educate you. Whereas with SE, our conversation partner is apparently educated in the topic or the claim. They're 98% confident that it's true. Why would I want to educate you? You're apparently there. Help me walk me through your reasoning on how you concluded that this is true. So it's a lot more, I think SE is a lot more passive and it's not pushing anything. I'm not educating you on this, although critical thinking might be an offshoot educational product or byproduct of an SE talk. I'm not here to educate you about how right or wrong you are. I want to explore with you about how right you think you are.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so that's a lot to think about. I am not very knowledgeable about like philosophy, for example, and I've only recently been connected with philosophers, and they seem very gung-ho about the Socratic method. And I'm personally struggling understanding that, like how that might work and also how it fits with SE, because it seemed like a lot of overlap. I guess one step further then, because as a classroom educator and somebody who helps other educators teach more effectively, do you know of anybody that uses SE in classes? Do you have any recommendations for educators that use SE in classes?
Personally, I don't have recommendations, but I have encountered several individuals over the last year or two who are literally teaching street epistemology to their classrooms and all different grades. The most recent conversation I had was an individual out of Dallas. He wants me to give a presentation to his international bachelorette group. It's a bunch of high schoolers that
baccalaureate. Yeah. The IB.
Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, because they have a theory of knowledge.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. It's an incredible program.
And as I understand it, it's a curriculum that regardless of where these students happen to be in the world, let's say if they're the family moves to Japan, the students can pick up pretty much exactly where they left off at that moment in time. But anyways, he's been teaching street epistemology over the last year and showing videos, and he's invited me to come and talk to his group. And there's also a fellow who's a high school teacher who started a street epistemology club at his local high school. And he has students. And in fact, he went out with one of the students and her dad went out to do street epistemology on the street with some strangers and just had an amazing time. What is his channel? I should think, I'll try to get you his channel name.
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah, let me look that up real quick because that's really important. But yeah, there are a lot of people who are doing SE in the classroom and teaching it. Which is really interesting because there's not a formal curriculum yet. It's one of the things that we're working on with the website, with the course that we're doing, the Navigating Beliefs course, is we're developing this foundational educational product, but then we expect to see offshoots. And I would love to have some off-the-shelf materials for people who want to teach SE in the classroom.
Do you know, like, other than the IB program, like what kinds of courses the SE approach might fit into?
The fellow's channel is called Navigate with Nate, by the way. So check
Navigate
that one out.
With Nate.
Yeah. And what was your question? Sorry.
What kinds of courses would you see SE fitting into? Like where in the traditional curriculum outside of IB would it fit? Because you know, I teach science. You know, that curriculum tends to be pretty full, although I'm advocating for adding these various other things that that I do, because I think it's a shortcut, but like I'm guessing maybe language arts, social studies, poli sci.
Maybe language arts. I think there's a little overlap probably with language arts and science. I wouldn't just reserve it for science. Do they still teach? Is language arts like English? Because when I went to school, it's called English class. Like that might be good. If there's a rhetoric class, or let's say there's a debate club, I would love to see this introduced as another approach to debate.
I don't know about you, but I have mixed feelings about debate.
I do too. Yeah, what do you tell me? What you?
Well, I get where they're coming from. It is important to be able to use evidence to support a claim. But the whole premise is based on winning,
Right.
and it's this versus this, as opposed to you know, the way that I teach scientific argumentation isn't like, woohoo, we win. There's a reality out there, and we want to discover what it is. And we understand that the best way to get there is to work together and test each other's evidence and reasoning. And it is much more of a collaborative approach than it is a sporting event.
Absolutely. I share those same views. In fact, we kind of frame it as such in the Navigating Beliefs course that we have for street epistemology, navigatingbeliefs.com. And we
Check
draw
out that
the,
course.
please do. It's the distillation of everything that we've learned about SE over the last 10 years, and it's amazing.
And it's free. Go
And it's
there.
free. Yeah, it's free. And we're going to be offering paid training for people that want to learn that way too. So yes, collaboration versus the debate. The collaborative way is so much more effective. You're working with your conversation partner to assess how they're reasoning so that they can adjust their confidence in alignment with the quality of their justifications. But also, it's an iterative process that I think would drive us closer to the truth. So if we're debating and we're arguing for our position, which could very well be wrong, we could be swaying people towards positions that are incorrect. Why the hell would we want to do that? And it's, yeah. Debate has its place. You could be sitting in the audience or watching online, and you can see somebody arguing really well for a position that you didn't have, and it changes your mind because you're not in the hot seat. There's a benefit to that. But if we want to, if we want to help the people around us in our lives hold beliefs that they're acting out on, that are more accurate or more justified, if that's something that's important to you. The collaborative approach of a technique like street epistemology is the way to go. And I hate to even say it like a technique, like it's a set of tools. It's sort of a way of thinking about how you're reasoning and incorporating them in your life ultimately. But in order to teach it, we've kind of boiled it down in some steps.
The scaffolding I find is really important. I have created my own little exercise on having students evaluate their beliefs, and it was very much impacted, influenced by SE, Socratic questioning, and so on. But I find that scaffolding, especially to start, is really helpful because it's like if I ask my students, think critically through this claim. Okay, like where do you
Right.
start?
Where do I start? And it was cool too, because when we started the development of the course, we asked the community, what are the topics that you would expect to see in a course on street epistemology? And we got deluged. We started categorizing it and then ordering them. And I love the order that we have now in the course where we talk about, we explain what street epistemology is definitionally, why it's important, like what goals people might have for using SE. And then we kind of cover the steps, but then we get into like the foundational stuff, the ethical considerations that we think are important, the typical mindset that is probably optimal to have when you're doing this type of interaction. For example, curiosity or epistemic humility, the collaborative mindset. These types of things. So we're structuring the training of the course to set people up for success when they learn it. We're covering the basics, and we've only re released the first phase of the course, which is the what, why, and how of, sorry, it's the what, why, and like the ethics and the mindset of SE and a little bit of rapport. Well, a lot about rapport. That's the first half. And then the second half is about how you do it. So the first half of the course is pretty much, it's mostly everything that you need to get to the point before a claim is surfaced, and it's substantial. So we've scaffolded this in a way so that it's introducing these concepts very slowly and with purpose, so that it makes people so that it builds people's confidence to the point where they use it. Because you can learn SE, but if you never practice it with others or yourself, then what's the benefit of that? We want to make a difference. We want to change the world. And I kind of speaking for Street Epistemology International here, like our mandate is to develop these tools and get them into as many hands as possible so that people can start using it, because we think it would make the world a better place.
I think you're right. And it's funny, so many thoughts while you're saying that. I kind of joke that I start with critical thinking training wheels. So when I first introduce how to think critically, I actually, and this was a question I had for you, I don't start with triggering examples. Like, there's a lot of forms of misinformation in the science class that are important to address, you know, like evolution or climate change or vaccines. I mean, there's strong scientific consensuses and a lot of misinformation. But those forms of misinformation are held really tightly to people who have certain identities or biases, worldviews, and so on. So if I go in and I start with that kind of misinformation, then some students are just going to get triggered. They're going to get defensive and they're not going to learn. So I start with witchcraft. You know, when I introduce falsifiability and supernatural, I don't go in with like God. I talk about actually Pythagoras thought that when he farted, he lost part of his soul. Okay, so test that. Like, I tell fart jokes and cats, you know, because I'm crazy cat. But importantly, what I'm trying to do is get students to learn the skills in a safe environment, where they can build the confidence and take off the training wheels and graduate to the bigger stuff.
Nice.
And so that was one of the questions I had for you, because when I see SE done, you know, the question is, one of the first questions, you know, what would you like to talk about? And sometimes they bring up really like deeply personal and very strongly held beliefs. So I don't know. Do you have thoughts on that?
I do have a lot of thoughts on that. The presentation of the topic largely runs the risk of overshadowing the process. And I've noticed that when I've given talks. In fact, I'll be invited to give a talk and people will say, "Well, you know, what example are you planning to show? Because we don't want to be too off-putting to half the audience." And I think that that's a valid point. And I've learned to recognize that. I usually choose benign examples like karma or something safe, a safe topic where you can see somebody exploring their belief, that particular claim, in an effective way that doesn't overshadow the technique. That's super important. And what I'm noting, and I've seen, I've there's so many times that people will. This is actually kind of a problem for the marketing of what we're doing. So, for example, a lot of the popular examples of street epistemology, and this kind of ties back to the training in schools. So, like, people will do a search for street epistemology and see really sensitive topics being explored, and that could just shut them off right from the start. So we have this very difficult marketing challenge where we want to showcase the method and how it can be used to explore these difficult topics at the risk of alienating the people who we want to reach because of the topic that's being explored. And there are people, in fact, there was one fellow in Portland, I think. He was invited to teach street epistemology to middle schoolers, I think. I forget their age. And this it's kind of being put on hiatus because of some of the examples that are out there today of street epistemology, which is really unfortunate. Like, we want this tool to spread, but how do you overcome people's initial knee-jerk reaction to, "Well, I don't want to learn about that because I don't like the claim that's being explored," or, "I don't like the style with which this person was using this technique," and it just shuts it down from the beginning. So we really have a marketing challenge that we're trying to overcome.
In my head, I kind of view it as like a sort of a spectrum, where in the middle is the stuff that it doesn't really trigger anybody or very few people. And that would be the, like, when I actually introduced the first scaffold of thinking through a claim, I start generally with either what is the capital of Australia, or how many species of elephant are there? Okay, the species of elephant tends to be pretty popular. So if I do that one, then we can walk through and they can see how that goes. And I'm like, so one of the questions is, how would you feel if you were wrong? Nobody cares. Actually, most people are like, oh, actually, that'd be awesome. I'd learn more about elephants, and who doesn't love elephants? So, okay, now that feeling, imagine that feeling for any of your other beliefs,
Right.
right? Imagine,
Ambivalence.
right. And so, like, what I do is they start there, and then I move over the semester, and I get to those other things, but I don't get there until I've taught them those skills first. Now, in my class, of course, my students, I joke that they're captive. For 4 months, they have to stay with me. They want a grade, right? This is their general education science class. They need the credit. In the real world, it's much less controlled. But at least in the classroom, I find starting with those safe examples and getting the skills and that feeling and then leaning into that. It's also fun. They laugh, you know?
In fact, this could be good advice for people who might be considering wanting to use an approach like street epistemology with family or friends. You can set aside the more difficult or triggering topics and just explore other more benign claims. Like they may make a comment about how red cars get more speeding tickets than any other car, and that's why they're not going to buy that red one. They're going to get a different color. That would be a nice, safe topic to explore where you're taking them through the steps of their reasoning. And if you do that enough on safer topics, they may start bringing up the more contentious claims, or you might feel more comfortable doing so. And they may feel more comfortable staying engaged longer because they've had that previous experience on those other claims. And this is the part that I love about street epistemology so much, is that in a way, the claim isn't even all that important. Which might be why I get so frustrated with the Socratic method focusing so much on the what and definitions. We're interested in the reasoning process that you used and how you're weighting this evidence and all these other things that apply to all the beliefs that you have, not just the one that we happen to be talking about. So I think there's a real value in just using this tool on benign claims over and over and over again so that you become more comfortable doing so, and that in a way you're sort of introducing other people to this type of reasoning in a safe way where they can be starting with benign claims and maybe reaching some of the more deeper ones that impact their identity and the tribes that they belong to. And there are costs that come with recognizing that, oh, I don't have a good reason for thinking this, but I always believed this my whole life, and now my marriage is at stake now because I don't believe this thing anymore. It could be very off-putting. So you have to, yeah, there's an on-ramp, I think.
So David McRaney, who I love, and if out there, if you haven't read How Minds Change, you should totally do that. Anthony is featured in that book, and for good reason. It's brilliant. He talks about something that I do in my class, which is around the dress. So that's one of those great examples of a claim where, like, it's a color of a dress. Like, everybody out there, I hope you know what I'm talking about with the dress. Is it either blue or black, or is it white and gold? So if you get a room full of people, and I'll do this with my students, and they've all seen the dress, but they've not been in a room full of people who see something differently. And then you let them fight it out a little bit. Like, wait a minute, how could you see that? And my husband and I have had great conversations about this because I think it's blue and black. And it is actually the real dress is blue and black. I just want to put it out there. I'm right and he's wrong, but he sees white and gold, right? So you argue over this and so on. Okay. What's more interesting there is the fact that it is the color of a dress and we see it differently. Imagine that same sort of perceptual errors happening for way more difficult issues.
Absolutely.
And more important, okay, we see this differently. Imagine now the goal not being to convince somebody else why I'm right, but oh, we disagree. That's fascinating. You actually see a different color. I want to know more. Let's figure it out. And again, it's about a color of a dress, so who really cares? But it's the same kind of thinking around, ideological issues and, politics and so on.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that example. And it does go to show how we can get so hung up on the differences that we don't step back to figure out, well, what's driving this? What's the underlying cause? Because there's clearly a lot of people who seem reasonable and rational who are coming to this conclusion and over here. And that we see that happening in social media and playing out in our culture today. We get so focused on the conclusions that we've arrived at, and we fight to defend them, and we're not interested at all about how we got there. And yeah, that's a wonderful example. And yes, I think David McReynie's show, he also has a podcast, by the way, that's just incredible. You Are Not So
You Are Not
Smart.
So Smart.
Yeah, I'd highly recommend that as well.
Actually, so I don't know about you. I'm curious to hear this from you, but the process of developing the course and was basically learning what I didn't know. And there was a lot that I didn't know, and there's probably way more that I still don't know. But in the process of learning to teach critical thinking, I learned a lot more about my own thinking. And it impacted not only how I think and how I perceive the world, but it impacted people around me. It impacted like my relationships with people because I can more understand they might actually be perceiving things differently. Why are they coming from that place? And the conversations that I have with them are different as opposed to me trying to vehemently defend a position. It's more about the relationship and trying to understand and work together.
Yeah.
So anyway, like it impacted me, but also I think it really improved my relationships. Thoughts?
Yeah. Well, before I learned street epistemology, my default was to argue for my position and to show how wrong the other person was. And I damaged relationships that I'm still attempting to repair, some of which I'm still attempting to repair today. And I don't know if I ever can. It has changed the way that I interact with people. And a great example is just even just recently dealing with a loved one who was basically in his last days. And family members were coming in, and everyone had an opinion of what needed to be done. And many people were very skeptical about the medical establishment. And I was running into a lot of this stuff. So I actually found myself leaning back on some of the skills that I learned along the way, where I was developing this course for street epistemology. And engaging with people where it wasn't real rigid, okay, let's identify your claim and let's get to your confidence. It was more free-flowing and natural. Like, I wonder what a good marker would be for us to look at before we were to shift from what we're doing now for treatment to what you're proposing. What do you have in mind? That type of stuff. So I was still able to maintain the relationships. They felt heard, I think, and listened to. And I think that they were given something to think about and consider, and maybe be a little bit more cautious before offering a suggestion. So I think that there are real world implications to learning these skills, and we need it. We need it more than ever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not claiming that critical thinking can solve all of our problems, but I think it's our best chance.
I think it's our best chance, and we need to start seeing it in the culture. Yeah, it's just so discouraging when you see very popular people on social media who are using the opposite, or even medical professionals who they should. I think that why are medical professionals not aware of this approach? Like I saw a video of Dr. Fauci going. This was like I don't know. This is like in the middle of COVID or something, but he was going to communities apparently where there was a lot of resistance to taking vaccines. And he was giving all the facts to show how safe this was. And it was just like running into a brick wall. And I've experienced that myself. And it's we know that this is a I no, I have high confidence that this is a better way. And we have a research study underway. We're in the tail end of being able to pilot it and then release it. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting there. I think this is better. I think this is a demonstrably better way to explore people's conclusions. That doesn't shut them down or cause defensiveness, and it opens people up to really considering their conclusions. And we need that more than ever. More than ever.
Yeah, I mean, there's the information deficit model was, which is the idea that people just don't know because they don't have enough facts, right? And for a very long time, that's what the education establishment worked under. Like, why don't students understand evolution? Well, they just don't have all the facts. And when I
Right.
give them the facts, they will accept it. And that's not how that works.
You might get lucky.
And
You might get lucky and find the person that that was exactly what they needed at that moment. Or it might be a benign claim like the elephant, how many species of elephants, for sure. But yeah, when it's those sensitive claims, it doesn't tend to work. When it's politicized, it doesn't tend to work.
I really so in my teaching I use the elephant and rider analogy, which Jonathan Haidt popularized, but it's this idea that you have in your mind an elephant and then a rider on top of the elephant, and the elephant is very strong. It's hard to control an elephant, and the elephant is the part of the brain that's always on. It's driven by its emotions, its biases, its assumptions. And the rider is the part of the brain that's able to think critically, but it's also really hard to control an elephant. It's work. And so most of the time what happens is the elephant just suggests something. This happens without our awareness, right? It suggests something to the rider, and the rider goes, "Yeah, that sounds right." And then if asked, "Well, here are all the reasons why my elephant is right." And so like when I talk about this in my presentations of like why facts don't change minds, in our brains, we have that. Like we have a writer who is our PR department or a lawyer for our elephant, but so does somebody else. So we think our writers are talking to each other, but actually it's driven by the elephant. So on the surface, it looks like I'm giving you facts and you're giving me facts. It looks like a fact-based argument, but it's not. It's the facts are the justifications, the shield that we use to protect those underlying claims that we want to be true. So if I'm trying to teach a student about evolution, for example, who doesn't understand or who won't accept evolutionary theory, I could explain what a theory is, right? I can explain biogeography and homologous structures and all of that. But why? What is the underlying motivation? Why don't they want to accept this? And it's probably because of the implications of accepting it. It's the, well, if I do that, that means I can't believe in God. Or if I do that, I lose my community and my family. My whole worldview crumbles. And when you view it that way, giving them facts seems doomed to fail. So this approach of trying to understand what is motivating the fact selection, digging down to find what the elephant is up to.
Right, that's key. And what we tend to find is that largely the elephant, largely in most people's case, is their psychosocial motivations. What do I need psychologically in order to cope with reality? And how am I reasoning? Are there deficiencies in my reasoning? There's also an interesting twist that I just sort of recently discovered. I'm sure I didn't discover it, but I noticed is that, people who have a resistance to the idea of free will don't like the rider and the elephant concept.
Oh,
They think that
interesting.
they think they're in total control of all the decisions that they make because they think that they have free will. So I think there's some resistance to this concept of how you're largely not in control of the conclusions that you're arriving at because there's this large elephant driving everything, essentially. That's a very off-putting concept to a lot of people.
No, but see, I would actually think it's the opposite. You're in more control when you're aware of what
Well,
your brain is doing.
I agree. Yeah, that's the solution to this whole thing. And that's why David McRaney's podcast is so great, because it teaches you all the deficiencies in our reasoning. And if you become aware of that, you become a better reasoner in general. And that may be far superior than after the fact, after you've consumed the reason, or you after you've acquired the belief, and now you've built justifications and you notice the benefits of this belief. We're coming in after the fact with SE and saying, okay, let's walk through your reasoning. It would be so much better to catch it on the front end and teach people these skills like you're doing, so that we're much more careful in the formation of the belief in the first place. So in SE, we're triaging. Where is this person at? Where do I need to meet them? Do they need evidence? Are they simply lacking a fact and that's all they need? Or would that fact be detrimental and cause them to become more defensive? Where are they at? That's a big part of street epistemology, is assessing where your conversation partner is at and then meeting them there and then beginning the exploration.
So in a science class, there are certain science-based concepts I'm trying to get across to students, but also like how the process of science works. And we're talking about empirical claims that have lots of support. So like, for example, with like, human-caused climate change. There are concepts that aren't empirical, or there are ones that are less supported. But I guess what I'm wondering is, like, in these situations where, say, there is a right answer, right? This is what we know about human-caused climate change. And what I'm trying to get you to do is evaluate that evidence yourself and understand why the scientific consensus is what it is. Why are we confident in this conclusion? But I can imagine in the real world where either non-empirical claims or those that have less support come into play, and my biases are likely to cloud the conversation. If I'm trying to have a conversation with somebody and I feel one way and they think another way, how do you in SE avoid your biases drive what you're doing in the conversation? Did
Okay,
that make sense?
I think so. You're wondering, it sounds like you're saying, how do you, as the person facilitating the exploration, keep your own biases out of it? Is that what you're asking? Or
Basically.
because there's another aspect that it seemed like you were going there. How do you account for the conversation partner's biases that happen to be coming up? And maybe this answer kind of applies to both sides of it. Well, let me talk about the SEER. It is important to recognize that you have biases. And one of the best ways that you can do to avoid that, or to avoid letting that influence your conversation, is to recognize them in yourself. And if asked, or if you feel like they wouldn't become too defensive, you can actually reveal that to them. Like, well, I don't really think that that's true because I've always operated under the impression that it's this. However, I'm interested in exploring your reasoning. You could do that. So that's one thing that you can do. Another thing is avoid asking leading and loaded questions. Really pay attention to the question that you're asking and inspect it before you ask it if you can, or even after the fact. You'd be like, was that a leading and loaded question? Did I imply something, or did I insert a premise when I asked that question? So there are some things that you can do before you even engage. And as far as your conversation partner's biases, one way that you can mitigate it is to take them out of the mix. Like, this is a collaborative exploration where we're working together. What would you think if somebody else walked by and came up to us and said the complete opposite, but they were using the exact same reasoning to arrive at their conclusion? So now we're collaboratively thinking about this third party individual who's not even there necessarily, and we're wondering aloud about what they would think of your conversation partner's reasoning, and their conversation partner is thinking about this third party. This is often referred to as an outsider test.
Oh,
And
okay.
it's really effective because it takes the pressure off of both of you. And it's this other individual who's not even in the party. So like, it's not going to fall on me. This other person. You may even know somebody who has this other belief and they've reasoned to it using your same reasoning process. What do you think about it? That is a really good way of taking people's biases out of it. So now you're thinking about it more objectively.
It's funny because I joke with my students that, when I'm teaching them biases and even fallacies, because we argue with ourselves all the time using fallacies. We think it's a good argument, but like we can get in our own way. And so, when I'm teaching them these skills, okay, sure, spot them in others first. They are way easier to see in others than they are to see in ourselves. Don't call it out, of course. People don't like that. And the goal is to turn it inward. But if you want to start by looking at somebody else and saying, you know what, that's just a bad argument because they're confirming their bias or, whatever. So what you're saying, that's what's called an outsider test.
Yeah, we refer to it as an outsider test. It started off as like an outsider test for faith. Like, if somebody concluded that their holy book was true and they concluded that this was the case because of faith, would you think about it? But you can apply that same model towards anything. If somebody thinks climate change is false because for the last 3 years the climate in their area was favorable, what would you think about their reasoning? You can still use that same sort of template regardless of the claim.
Huh.
Yeah, that helps. Now, there are other things that you can do too. trying to think what else might come to mind. Third-party thinking is really important, like helpful. Making it more abstract is really good too. Like, I think the further you get away from the actual claim being explored and you're talking more broadly about things, that could be really useful. Like, how do you think, like, if there's maybe there's an argument or a discussion about the meaning of words, you could have a discussion. Well, how do you think words are created? What's that process like? Or we get hung up on truth a lot. That's a real big sticking point where we'll get halfway through the conversation only to realize that they think they don't need evidence to support this claim because it's true to them. It's their personal truth. And therefore, they're justified in thinking that this is true and acting out in the world. So sometimes we hit these little stumbling blocks along the way, and then we have to recognize it and then explore it with them.
Do you suppose that's just a it's difficult to know intent, of course, but do you suppose that's a justification somebody gives themselves just to protect a belief that they don't want to be wrong?
I
They
think
may or
so.
may not actually believe that, but if I say this to myself, then I can keep believing it.
I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it. But they don't, I don't think they recognize that they're just saying this to themselves in order to keep the belief. They haven't noticed that yet. That's a part of it. I do also think that sometimes people say, well, I have my own truth, they have their own truth, and they're just as right as I am. If I've got this box of Tic Tacs and I think that there's an even number in there and they think that there's odd, we're both correct. I think people go in that direction, especially on more sensitive topics like abortion or trans issues or whatever. People tend to go, I call that relativistic or subjective. They tend to go relativistic when they recognize that this could be upsetting to another person. I think it's coming from a place of compassion, but it's too much compassion. It's actually letting subjective truth override objective truth in that way. So sometimes I'll even frame my questions to head that off, and I say something like, if we were to count out these total number of pieces and we discovered that it was an odd number and somebody else said it was even though they have a right to think that, what would you think about their reasoning? And it sort of heads that off at the pass where you're acknowledging that they could believe it, but would they be accurate in believing it? And it's an important shift in framing.
I can't remember the study authors, but I remember seeing a study. I'll try to find it and put it in the notes that found that when we have unfalsifiable, no, when we have a claim that we want to believe, that we provide evidence for the claim. And the more that claim has been disproven, the more we shift that claim from being a falsifiable one to an unfalsifiable one. So when the facts fail, we just move the goalpost to, well, that's my truth, or it's a value judgment or something like that.
Yeah.
And so in my classes, what I tend to do, so critical thinking is great, but if you don't do it, then it doesn't help you, right? You have to want to do it. And the more we want to believe something, the less we want to challenge that belief. And so I use a lot of what's the harm questions. I don't know if this would be so like for example, when we talk about back to homeopathy, so people might say, well, I felt better. Or, it's my right to believe, or something like that, or it worked for me. Okay, so can there be harm from using homeopathy if it doesn't work? Well, let's look. And what you see is, well, like a box of the flu medicine is like $30. Okay. I'm too cheap to waste my money on things that aren't actually working. So to me, $30 wasted is a monetary harm. But also, there are people that have died from using homeopathy in place of evidence-based medicine. There could be everything from bodily harm to death. And so I try to focus it on, well, what might be the consequences of not aligning your belief with reality? And I think intention does get in the way there, because like if my intention is, if I'm well-meaning, if my goal in believing something is to protect what I think is a marginalized group or something, then my intentions are good, and so I feel justified in using these techniques to support this reasoning. The problem is that maybe my intentions, while well-meaning, the actual actions result in harm. And so getting them to focus on that a bit further of, well, if you actually want to do good, then is what you're proposing actually helping?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Very good. Yeah, the right. I think people are well-intentioned. They mean well, and people are generally good, and they want good things for other people. That's generally the starting point. But mostly this comes down to something that we've recognized as a truth valuation issue. For with regards to this specific claim, it sounds like you don't so much care about whether it's true or not, as long as it's serving some need. And we don't tend to do that. Like, I don't walk into the bank and think I'm going to cash this $100 bill, and if the teller gives me $10 back only, then I'm going to be satisfied with that. I value accuracy in most other aspects of my life, but when it comes to certain beliefs, we lower our valuation of truth so that we can continue believing it. It's wild. And I think your example of exploring the downsides of such a philosophy is really useful. And there's a really good example on my channel with a woman. I talk with her twice. And the first time she comes up and we talk about truth. And the very first thing is she says something like, if it's not harming me or anybody else, why can't I just believe it? And then by the end of the talk, she realized that there were some deficiencies with that. It could actually prevent her from understanding the real trueness of the situation. So she recognized the value of that. And then she came back later. We actually explored one of her claims that spirits were real. So, yeah, having them recognize that there might be deficiencies in this type of philosophy could be problematic. And then this kind of ties back to what we talked about, sort of an outsider perspective. When you overlay their truth valuation for this specific claim to somebody else, they tend to want a higher valuation of truth for them. So I remember this great conversation I had. It was on Blab or something like 7 years ago, where a woman said, faith is this wonderful thing. And I would get on an airplane. If I had two options, to get on this airplane that was checked by mechanics, or to get on this other airplane that I could just take it on faith that it was safe, I'd go to the one that I can take it on faith. But when I write, because the implications for the claim that had been surfaced previous, it was a very important claim. But when we shifted it, so it wasn't her getting on the plane, it was her daughter who's had a miraculous birth or something. She wanted her daughter to get on the plane with the mechanics checking it. So what's going on there? And you're muted again.
Sorry, the harm got much more real, right? So the harm was
Yes.
somebody that she wasn't willing to gamble
Which
on.
makes you wonder if she has a low valuation of her own self or something. What's going on there? Why wouldn't the weight be equal?
Yeah.
Why is it more for her daughter than herself?
Wow. Wow, I need a link to those in this, by the way, too. So let's put that down there.
I don't think I have a recording of that one, but there were a few people that observed that, I think. And yeah, I might have a recording of it actually, now that I think about it. I think I do. It's not on my channel. It's on a hard drive somewhere.
I can't imagine the amount of hours you have recorded.
I have a ton of examples, and I've started going through my archives to pull some of the older stuff, just to show what a typical day was like, to go out in public, and some of the conversations in between where it wasn't like a full-blown SE conversation, but somebody made a quip about the weather, how it's so unpredictable here in San Antonio, Texas. It'd be sunny in the morning, and before you know it, it's raining. It's unique to this area. Well, okay. That might be fun to explore. Dropped in a question or two, and she went on her way to the trail. It was a great little moment.
Interesting. Okay. I think I have hit all of my questions for you. Did you have anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I think the one thing I want to talk about is what do you think we need to do to make this more commonplace and popularize it? Because it seems that all of our efforts, they're good. We're reaching some people, but it doesn't seem like it's big enough to make a difference. So I don't know if you agree. What is your assessment with where we're at now and where we need to be and some of the impediments that might be in the way?
So this is going to come from a place of my bias, of course, here. But do you know John Cook? He's the Cranky Uncle. Like, if you've never played Cranky Uncle, it's the game on science denial. He's widely published on science denial. The author of the 97% Consensus on Climate Change. Anyway, he's also a good friend, and I had the same question with him at one point. And I said, like, with my website and social media accounts. I mean, I was growing, I had good numbers and engagement, and there's room to improve. But at some point, you kind of feel like you're speaking to the choir. And how do you get more people involved? And he said educators, and it's because if you get one educator, you get all of their students, not just this year, but all of the years. And so every educator you get gets you infinitely more than just a net cast. More broadly. And I've really taken that advice to heart, and it's why I've shifted some of my communication to educators. They're still a hard group to get to because it's the education system in the United States is so decentralized. And the concepts, the kinds of things that we teach don't neatly fit anywhere. And so I've tried, publishing in science journals, going to science educator conferences, and working now with the Mental Immunity Project. And we're doing something similar, trying to identify the different subjects where this might fit. Hitting conferences, national conferences are challenging because they're expensive and they're difficult to get to for some educators. So regional ones, professional development. I mean, most educators have to get ongoing professional development. And the lesson plans that we give them, making them as easy to use as possible, like what standards does this meet? How would this look in your class? And these are concepts that are new to educators. Like, I didn't know about logical fallacies and cognitive biases. So if I'm asking an educator to teach about those concepts, then I need to provide them with the support that it's not too heavy of a lift because they have a lot of other things to do. So yeah, that's my approach now is the educator. And I'm curious what you think of that actually, and what kinds of advice you could give me.
Oh, I think the educating side of it is really critical. I'm worried that there seems to be a growing trend to disparage academic institutions, like calls to burn them to the ground and this kind of stuff. Like, well, what are you planning to replace it with? If it would be this type of teaching, I would be for it. But if it's something more autocratic, I'd be worried about it. So, I'm encouraged by the idea of educators noticing street epistemology and wanting to incorporate these concepts or the importance of critical thinking. I'd like to see it more in by the popularizers who are on social media. I would love it if, Elon Musk comes to mind. He has such a broad reach and such power. But he uses it for the opposite of what I think we need to improve the world. He's making things worse. And not just to pick on him. We see this across the board. There's a disincentive for civil, compassionate exploration of people's reasoning. And it's so much easier to dunk on people and tear them down and generate propaganda for your point of view. So we have a
And
real
let's be
uphill
real.
battle.
I'm sorry. The algorithms reward that too. So it's not just the individuals, people who do that get more interactions and then they're seen by more people. The kinds of reasoned approach that we're trying to promote is a harder sell
It is.
because it doesn't trigger people and get them and pitchforks and so on.
Another angle that I think we're doing is the development of the course that we put out. It's called Navigating Beliefs, and it's awesome. And what I suspect will happen over the coming years is we'll see industry-specific variations. So a form of street epistemology or navigating beliefs where it's for medical professionals on how to talk with patients or family members that are coming in that have questions. Or maybe there's a journalism component for journalists or something for politicians over here, educators. Industry-specific variations that account for those challenges that are in those specific spaces and ways to overcome them to incorporate these tools and make them more commonplace. That's kind of the direction that we're heading in with Street Epistemology International. But I'm open to other ideas, and I probably have other ideas. They're just not maybe necessarily coming to mind at the moment.
The other thing that occurs to me, my husband is a musician. He's a conductor, and he for a very long time has used music to help singers have more productive conversations. Music touches people in a way that like cold facts and such can't. And so he'd bring in music with a certain issue and then teach the students how to have productive conversations around those issues. And just conversations over the years, like, well, I teach students how to think and you teach them how to have conversations. So maybe we could work together on this. And so we've actually created a curriculum. We call it Critical Conversations. And it's an approach where it's the teaching people to recognize their biases and the kinds of things that could influence their thinking, their perceptual errors, and how to have conversations around these issues. And we use it for like DEI training. And we've done it on with academic institutions and with some nonprofits and so on. And DEI is such a big business in the United States, and there's a lot of people who want to do something in DEI, so diversity, equity, and inclusion. DEI training is essentially ubiquitous throughout even, industry. The problem is that most of those approaches are ineffective at best and potentially even counterproductive. And but people still want to do something, right? They're well-intentioned. They want to create environments in their spaces, communities where people can feel free to be themselves and also think better and make better decisions and have better conversations. And so I guess what I'm wondering is if there is a way to put an approach like this into a curriculum like that and get into organizations that would provide them with skills that are useful to them, but also you teach them something very useful in the process.
Yes. And in fact, that's an area that we're very interested in at Street Epistemology International. We've even done some corporate training, and I've given a couple, one or two corporate presentations to very large multinational companies to offer them this potential. And in fact, one of them, it was their DEI group specifically that was looking for some ideas. And yeah, I think that that's a way to go. That would be quite lucrative as well. So there would be a financial benefit for teaching it. That would be an income source for Street Epistemology International. It'd be an income source for people who would want to teach street epistemology, for example. And it would introduce these ideas to people who may not ever be exposed to them. So, for example, we did a street epistemology training class to a call center on the West Coast, and these are, what are they? Minimum wage employees. They probably work 40, 50 hours a week. Probably not a lot of spare or free time to read a book or watch an SE video. They're more interested in maybe other things. But by introducing them these skills on how they could be more effective communicators on the phone, invariably they're going to learn these skills for other aspects of their life so that when they go home and talk to their kids or their spouse, we're hopeful that these skills would propagate that way. So that is a And because there's that financial benefit of organizations becoming more efficient and less issues and better all around, making better decisions, that could be a really powerful mix that is completely untapped at this moment. And we're moving in that direction. That is an area that we're really interested in, and we're putting some time towards that, developing that.
And I suppose it's worth saying, if you're listening to this and have ideas, put them in the comments. I don't know about you, Anthony, but I am all ears.
Listen, reading the comments voraciously is what made me get better at street epistemology. I know a lot of people say never read the comments. That's the worst advice. You need to have a thick skin. Don't get me wrong. Some of it's like, why are you making a comment about me wearing flip-flops out there? Like, what's the big deal? So sometimes you get like personal attacks and things like that, but there's a lot of good nuggets of advice, and even the bad advice makes you think. And sometimes you discover other things. That's what's driven street epistemology to become better, is the public exposition of the techniques and listening to the criticisms and evaluating it and then incorporating that and making change. We've been failing forward and improving and evolving. That's what's made this approach really, really effective, I think, is that kind of feedback. So yeah, read the comments. To leave the comments and we'll read them.
I've had a lot of misogynistic comments that I've I just people why? Just don't do
Is
that.
there a slider or something that you can use, maybe in YouTube, to sort of filter some of that stuff out? There might be a way that you can increase the threshold on that type of stuff if you're getting a
I
lot of
mean, to
that.
be fair, right now most of my my biggest fa site is Facebook, and that's where I get the most comments. And And I've
Sorry to hear
really
that.
tried hard on that place, on that site. Like to me, my science communication is an extension of what I do in the classroom. And I want to create the same kind of environment in the spaces that I've put out there that I do in my class, which is a place where people feel safe to ask questions, to have conversations. And it just takes a couple of trolls to come in and pollute the whole thing. And so I do have to be in the comments and, you know, or, am I going to try here? And if I do, how might that go? And sometimes I've been pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I had one in particular that kind of stands out where he was really upset, like just really, really angry. And I said, let me give some thought to what you're saying and I'll prepare a response. And I took a few days. It wasn't just like an immediate thing. And I had a response, and surprisingly, he like double, tripled, quadrupled down even more. It was just really, and I had to eventually block him. But that's extremely rare. Most of the people, I think, at least in my circles, who are drawn to this don't usually go that route. This it might be an indication that you're getting out beyond the bubble that you're currently in. Like, it might actually be a benefit in a weird way. You might be reaching people where these concepts are new and they're not quite understanding what you're attempting to do or your justifications for it. It might be an indicator, a positive one, even though it's negative.
You know what I the if I were to the concept that I find triggers people the most, ironically, is intellectual humility. When I suggest that you might not know what you think you know, that someone might know more than you, that there's something else to potentially be learned. You might not remember what you think you remembered. That experts really do have expertise within their area of expertise. Like, for some reason, that triggers a certain kind of person. And that's when I get the worst comments.
The worst comments, well, the biggest pushback I've noticed in street epistemology circles is this idea of you're platforming bad ideas, and
Oh.
therefore you shouldn't be talking about that because you're giving this person space. Because we do, when we're doing SE, we want to explore how they're reasoning and we want to work within their model. And sometimes their model is very, very ugly. And giving them the ability to the space to talk about those things is upsetting to a lot of people. But what makes people more upset, and I'm on board with this part of it, like I'm for the exploration of bad ideas publicly. I don't care what it is. I think it should happen. We should never shut anybody down. But what could happen in an SE talk is you can be asking questions to understand, but never ask questions that challenge. And if you
Oh.
don't ask challenging questions, then I could see how it might be perceived as platforming bad ideas or ideas that I find problematic, something along those lines. I love SE because, yes, it's great for understanding where a person is, but it's superb at challenging people in a productive and effective and civil way. And if you don't go to that deeper level of questioning, you're missing out on an opportunity to help them reflect on their reasoning and maybe reconsider the views that they're espousing. that they're espousing, not espousing, that they're espousing. And ultimately, it's up to the SE practitioner how deep you want to go with your questions. But I would urge people that once you learn and become comfortable with these tools, go down to the foundation, go down to the epistemology, explore how they're testing their reasoning. That is so key. Because the other stuff here at the top that may be upsetting to people is noise. We want to get down to the foundation to see how people are reasoning, because that impacts all of the beliefs that they hold.
Okay, when you say explore the foundations of testing their reasoning.
Yeah, the epistemology, that what, why, how. Yeah, we want to get down to the
So
how.
let's say that you had somebody where I don't, ghosts come to mind. Okay. So somebody who really, really believes in ghosts. And so what you're saying is that some SE practitioners don't really dive down to the bottom. So what would diving down to the bottom look like?
Diving down to the bottom would be, let's start at the what. I think ghosts are real because I hear
Actually,
footsteps
can
coming.
we play this out? I have a loved one who very firmly believes in ghosts, and I think I can do this.
Yeah. What would they say is right? That's the claim. All right. They think ghosts are real. Now, we might spend a little time exploring what ghosts mean. Like, what's the definite? How would they define the word ghost?
Sensing the presence of people around you, that you've lost, even seeing them in pictures.
Oh, okay. This is good, because
Okay.
I was envisioning, that's such a great question that I asked there, because I was envisioning something completely different, an apparition that you would see floating down the hallway. But you're telling me that it's something different, that it's a an inter did you say an internal sense or something?
Yes. So, like, for example,
An idea?
I could feel my father standing next to me.
Okay.
And when we took a picture, it's the orbs, right? So that orb would be proof that my father was there.
Okay, so there we have a reason. So we've kind of identified what you mean by ghost, and your reason is, well, I feel it. I could feel that he's there or something. And we've taken this picture, and then there's these what look like apparitions, or that's yeah, we see little orbs or something in this picture, and that's why. Driving deeper, so languishing at the what and why would be like, what kind of film did you use on your camera, or does it make an audible sound, that type of stuff. Like, you're kind of at the higher level. The how level would be, how could we determine that taking pictures of what we think are spirits is actually what's happening? How could we determine that this internal feeling that you have and you're attributing it to a ghost, how could we actually tell if that's the case? We want to get into the testing part of it. And that doesn't tend to happen on some of the more salacious popular claims that I'm seeing online. We tend to really focus on the what and maybe a little bit of the why, but it's the how. How can we actually figure out that that really is a ghost that's captured in this picture? Like, we've got the picture, we can see the orbs, you know, what look like orbs. How can we actually determine that that's what it is you're saying that it is? And it's the exploration of the testing process that gets deep. And that's where people slow down and they tend to start thinking more critically.
What I'm imagining happening in that conversation is something that goes to what it boils down to, and this is my interpretation of it. They really want to believe in the ghost. They
Yeah.
want their father to be there. That comforts them. And that's about the level of interrogation that they're willing to do.
Right. So that's fine. And you should commend somebody who reveals something so honest. Like, okay, thanks for, you know, that's really great to hear. One thing that you could do, and I've done this many times, and others will do it as well, is and my colleague Reed, Nice Wonder, actually, I think, came up with this or brought it to my attention, is what would be the next best reason? So let's imagine that there's somebody who doesn't believe in ghosts and they take this picture and they see the orbs. What do you think that they would conclude happened? Right. This is an outsider. This is kind of a combination of outsider test, but also getting to next best explanations. And they may start giving plausible reasons. Now they may say, well, nothing. It could only be ghosts. Okay. Well, that's, but people don't usually do that. They say, well, okay, the film was a little old. It's been sitting on my shelf for about 2 years, so maybe there's a problem with the film, or maybe there were some streetlights out there. They start entertaining defeasibility to their own reasoning. Because you've hopefully by this point created a psychologically safe space for that type of introspection. That's a key part of SE is the building and maintaining of rapport so that when you reach these critical moments of reflection, they feel safe to do it.
What I think is interesting about what I just heard you say, so these are in science, I would call those alternative explanations or multiple working hypotheses. Is Carl Sagan famously called them multiple working hypotheses. Alternative explanations is basically the same thing. Okay, well, it could be. What else could it be? So you called them next best reasons. Okay.
This gets to the overlap of critical thinking and scientific method. And it's kind of funny, like it's funny because we've sort of developed this somewhat independently, but we notice these overlaps. So I think it gives an indication that there might be something to it if we're arriving at similar things that you can do that help people reflect on their reasoning. And yeah, that could be a really good way of helping people take another look. And this goes back to something I said earlier. Don't offer things for them to entertain. Ask them what they would need, what they think would be plausible. Because more than likely, if you say, well, what about the lights outside the window? They would say, well, the blinds were closed. What about the film? Oh, that was new film. Or, yeah, it could have been the old film, but I bought some film the other day and it was probably that film that was in there. We're so good at knocking down things, but if you ask them to explore alternative explanations and they're surfacing them, then they're likely surfacing ones that they would consider. And then once you've identified a couple of alternate explanations, how could we tell if it's this alternate explanation or the one that you currently have? And then something really interesting happens. They notice that they have a discrepancy in standards. My standard for accepting this explanation is really low. And my standard for accepting this alternate explanation is really high. Well, you need to show me the manufacturing date on this thing, this film, and I need to see a study to show that this film is never deficient in this area with this kind of lighting. Right? Whoa. But they don't need that kind of high standard for their conclusion that it's orbs. And then you can explore the discrepancy in standards.
I will tell you one of the issues that I have is that I go like this all the time, and my brain's just constantly going. And so when I get in a conversation like this, it is not my intention to come across aggressive at all. But I think what ends up happening is just like the flow and the questions, they come across more as an interrogation than they do
Yours or what?
mine. I
Oh,
know
really?
mine do.
A tone is important. Like we have a whole chapter. It's module six. It's building and maintaining rapport, and we talk about the types of things that we can do that make people more defensive. And it gets in the way of their psychological safety, and then they become more defensive, and they won't entertain the great questions that you have for them. And recognize, I'm glad that you recognize it, right? You need to recognize this first in order to fix it. So you're halfway there. And there are things that you can do. But it could be triggering as the questioner when you hear somebody say something that's upsetting to you or you want to take shortcuts and just sort of jump right to something and without sort of making sure that they're along with you. You have to just, what helps is really just checking in with them. How is this going? Do you like the questions that I'm asking? Am I talking too much? Would you rather I be more direct or, give me some feedback so that I can ask you better questions and make this more of a collaborative thing. I would just be honest with them and say, I have this problem where I tend to sometimes ask questions that are upsetting to people. And that's the last thing that I want to do, because that's going to get in the way of my understanding and it's going to prevent me from asking better questions. So if you have any issues with the way that this is going, please let me know.
I don't know about you, but I mean, social media is a difficult place to have these conversations. It's much easier face to face. But sometimes I struggle with, I should preface this. I joke that my communication efforts are for the normals. So like on a bell curve, there's people over
Normies,
here.
normies or normals? I've heard
I call them
normies.
normals. Well, yeah,
Normals?
normie has a different connotation. So the normals.
Is
So
it?
people, well, yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, people, when they say normie, it can be a bit derogatory.
Maybe loud, like they're not plugged in. Yeah, but what's a
Yeah.
normal?
A normal
Agree.
is so like, okay, we've got our bell curve on anything from understanding to willingness to learn. And people over here don't need me, right? People over here with my time and skill set probably aren't reachable. I could get a lot more bang for my buck by focusing on the vast majority in the middle that are movable. And I actually think this is one of the failures of a lot of science communicators. The positions over here are sometimes really easy to attack. They are so obviously wrong, at odds with the evidence, based on poor reasoning. But, that low-hanging fruit, I mean, most people don't hold that position. And by going after that position, all the normals in the middle have no idea what the hell you're talking about, right? They're like, so for example, right now, one of the things that I see is there are some of the misinformation, I should say disinformation spreaders in the medicine space that deny germs. So they're germ theory deniers or they're AIDS deniers. Okay, the vast majority of people don't hold that position. But by going after them, it gives them oxygen. And then everybody else in the middle gets exposed to an idea that they never would have been exposed to. And then they go, wait a minute, wait, people believe that? And then we lose the chance to actually reach them. And
Okay.
so my idea is that if we hold enough of them, we can move the curve and they become less and less relevant. But my question is then, like, how do you, it's a curve, it's a spectrum, right? So where do you draw that line? And I guess maybe I should be asking whether you fundamentally agree or disagree with that strategy.
Yeah. I'm skeptical of that. I think it's great to go after the people in the middle. That's awesome. Right, these are the people who they're going about their daily lives. They vote. They're not that tied into the beliefs, and that could be really helpful to reach them. But it's the people who are on the fringes that they're there because they're really, really convinced that they're true, that they're right, and in many cases they're motivated. I think it increases their motivation to act out on it. So they may start a YouTube channel or a Twitch stream or a TikTok thing, right? Or a Twitter account. And now they're reaching those people in the middle. So I think it's imperative that we spend time reaching the people on the extremes. And that's what I love about SE. It gives you the confidence to talk with people who are in these extremes, who are acting out on it and generating content to convince the people, the normies or normals in the middle. So we need I hate to say warriors. This is I don't like the war metaphor, but we need people who are skilled enough to engage with people who are on these extremes, to reach them, and maybe in some cases expose the faults in their reasoning to those people that are in the middle. That's really important because they're susceptible to this information, and it's very easy to develop a persona of confidence and authority and convince people of bad information. So we have to engage in those dark corners with those folks.
I do agree that someone needs to. I do worry about a lot of oxygen going to those spaces. For example, there's a woman at my
The
gym.
oxygen, can I just say, the oxygen is getting there anyways, right?
Yeah.
And yes, they may up. Here's the thing. If I were to talk to a flat earther. In fact, I think I have. I've had conversations with people who are influential and we've exposed faults in their reasoning, and they've asked to not release the video because they understand the implications that that would have on their followers and that type of thing. So there's,
Oh no, but wait a minute. What do you do in that situation? Because your whole purpose in engaging with them was to take away that oxygen.
I respect their wishes, and if they don't want something to go out, consent is very important to me, and boundaries. I try to respect that, of course.
No,
But
that makes perfect sense.
if somebody's on Twitter saying something that's false, I want to be there to point that out or to offer to engage with them in the quality of their reasoning. But what I find is that they won't do it. There's too much of a downside. So there are impediments to reaching people who are in those extremes, who are gener we're talking about a very narrow niche, by the way. They're not only in the extremes, but they're generating content to influence the center. But there are ways of reaching them, and it might be more effective to talk with them and expose faults in their reasoning if they're influencing the middle.
See, like I always think of my students as normals. Like my students are general education science students at a community college, and over the years they've taught me about what the average person knows about science, what they need to know, and how to reach them. And I find that like there's a woman at my gym, and she's like, "What is critical thinking?" Right. That's a normal. Most people have no idea what it is. Or if they have some idea, they don't know much.
There's an extreme. I remember running to a street preacher here in San Antonio, and the topic of critical thinking came up. I don't know. Maybe I was explaining what I was doing, and he pegged it as critical thinking, and he disparaged it. Oh, you're doing that critical thinking stuff out here? Critical thinking? It was a threat. It was a threat. Critical thinking is a threat to some people's worldviews, and I wonder if there are some people who actually recognize that this is a problem and want to prevent this from happening. I don't want to get all conspiratorial and everything, but a population that critically thinks is like, that's the ultimate. That would be a great goal if
I
from my
actually
point of
like, I
view.
think I vaguely remember the state of Texas putting into their or attempting to putting into their state science standard something that was opposed to critical thinking.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I might have to look that up. I'm not sure if it passed or whatever, but yeah, I mean that,
It's been
yeah, I
demonized.
agree
It's
with you.
literally been demonized. Like, that's the of
But
the
the
devil
normals
in some
don't know what it
cases.
is. And so if I can teach the normals, like, you know what? Someone's trying to take advantage of you. Here's how you can think through that and not fall for that.
Right. This is good stuff to learn so that when someone knocks on your door and offers to sell you something, you could be more prepared. It helps you become less gullible. But there are forces, I think, in our culture that prefer that. That is a useful thing for a lot of people. And promoting street epistemology, critical thinking, scientific method is a threat to some people's philosophies. We have an uphill battle.
Yeah, because if I have learned anything over my time doing this, it is that it would be infinitely easier to fool people and part them of their money than it is to convince people to not get fooled and not waste their money. Like it is so frustrating to watch people get fooled, and yet it's so counterintuitive in my mind, and I can't necessarily figure out why, except that that money spent is a bit of false hope. It's like it feels empowering. It's not, but it feels like I'm doing something.
That's
And
sad.
once we've been fooled, it's very difficult to admit we've been fooled.
Well, yeah, then because then your ego gets in the way, and there's that sunk cost fallacy and all that other stuff that comes into play. And what's even more sad is that when there is a percentage of the population that even when they discover that their reason is faulty, and this gets back to our discussion about truth valuation, they're fine with it. They're fine going through life believing something that may not be true because of the benefit that it gets from, because of the benefit that they get from it. And that's very sad to me. I understand the psychology behind it, and life is difficult, and not everyone has the privilege or the resources that I might have, that type of stuff. But yeah, it's really discouraging that even people, when you get down to it, in many cases, they're okay with being deceived. they're okay with self-deception because it's what they happen to need at that moment in life. And you have to recognize that too. I think that that's an important recognition that that's where they're at right now. That's about all that they can do, and it's time to step away.
Yeah,
Now,
sometimes it's about planting a
I
seed.
might, huh? What's that?
Sometimes it's about planting a seed.
Yeah, I mean that helps. Yeah, I guess I'm optimistic that that's where they're at now. They may need some more time to process, and then you have to sort of step away. My dividing line is the amount of impact that they're having. If this is a person who doesn't value the truth, but they're generating content to influence other people to that same degree, then that's a green light for me to proceed and keep exploring their beliefs. I mean, I'm not going to force anybody to, but that would be like, okay, now that's a worthwhile conversation to have because of the impact that they're having. It's important for people to recognize that they don't value truth, that it's more important for them to message this idea or hold on to this belief or convince other people that they're right. Then I think it's important to proceed.
You know, that actually, I could see your point there. And I hadn't really considered the people who are doing it to influence other people, as opposed to people who just hold fringe beliefs. Have you seen Behind the Curve, Beyond the Curve?
I have. Yeah. That ending scene. What do you, yeah.
Like that movie is so brilliant because it humanizes people who are flat earthers. Other people like to dunk on flat earthers, right? But you get to see their reasoning and you get to see the personal benefit that they get from holding those beliefs. And
Yeah.
the part that bothered me, there was the devising the tests to test their beliefs and
Yeah.
disproving their beliefs and yet finding ways to not accept the results of the test. But what I thought was most fascinating was the woman in there, and I don't remember her name, but she was conspiratorial, and you know, you have to be to hold these fringe views. But at one point, because the misogyny in the community is obvious, and she became the target of conspiracy theories. And she got so close to seeing it, but still not quite.
Yeah.
Didn't make it there.
There's that scene in the car, right? I think she's driving or something, or yeah, that was a really powerful moment.
So, I
Yeah.
mean, I show my students that movie because, well, I recommend it to them for that reason. But I guess back to the critical thinking training wheels. Like, I use flat earth as a non-triggering belief. I've never had a flat earther in class. The vast majority of people aren't flat earthers. So, for most normals, that's a belief you can dunk on, right? It's something stupid. Like, can you believe that people actually believe that? But people actually really do believe that.
They may
And
have
that
f
it's
family members that do, if they don't themselves.
But so stepping back though, it's not just the training wheels approach, it's easier to see in others. When I start class, the first lecture is on witchcraft and the witch trials in Europe from like the 15th through the 18th centuries. And the idea is for students to be able to see from a bird's eye view their reasoning, their evidence, and the conclusions they drew from it. They were very convinced they were right. I mean, they were so convinced they probably killed hundreds of thousands of people. But it's easier for them to reflect on that, like the flat earther, and see that and then turn it in on themselves. But I wouldn't do it necessarily to address that. My point isn't addressing witchcraft beliefs or flat earth beliefs. It's to see what that reasoning looks like in someone else.
Yeah, that's the goal. That's what we're trying to do with street epistemology. It's to help people critically reflect on the quality of their reasoning through civil conversation. And it's that act of reflecting that we think is the breakthrough that we all need to be less dogmatic about our conclusions and act out in the world in a more responsible way that results in human flourishing and reduces suffering. That's what we're
The
aiming for.
reduced dogmatism is, I think, one of the key takeaways. Like, if I had to give people one takeaway, it would be to be more humble in your beliefs and stop thinking about them in terms of right or wrong, yes or no, but proportioning them and allowing yourself to move with your confidence. And in order to do that, holding them less tightly. I don't know. Takeaway for you, one takeaway.
That's the goal. I can't say it any better than that. Like that's really what we're aiming for. Yeah, as a more epistemically humble and responsible society across the board.
Well, I'm rooting for you, Anthony.
I'm rooting for you. You're doing great work. It's good to see you on TikTok too. How's that going?
The Street Epistemology Podcast is a production of Street Epistemology International. The views, guests, and topics expressed here, or not expressed here, do not necessarily represent those of the organization.